For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. Welcome to another edition of Cyber Law and Business Report. This is Bennett Kelly, and we're broadcasting from the Internet Law Center here in downtown Santa Monica, the heart of Silicon Beach. Please be seated. We got a great show for you today. And as part of our Miami Book Fair specials, we're continuing and we're talking with the author of The Browns of California, the family dynasty that transformed a state and shaped a nation. And with us is Miriam Powell, and she is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist turned historian. She's also the book of The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, which won her a Robert Kennedy Human Rights Book Award and a National Book Critics Circle finalist for that same book. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And so when this year, by the way, it's an excellent book. It was very well written. And the book begins with the current governor's great-grandfather, a German immigrant who in the 1860s bought a ranch that apparently Governor Brown will be retiring to. And that is coming in this January, which will be the end. When he leaves office in January, he'll be the third longest serving governor in American history, ending a dynasty that began when his father took office in 1859, and the two of them have really reshaped California history in different ways. So the book is very timely in that respect. And I guess what is it that led you to write this?
Well, I think what the genesis of it was really exactly what you were just describing, the fact that the governor began to talk a lot in speeches about his great-grandfather and about the land in Northern California where his great-grandfather had settled on, and the idea that he was planning to return to that land when he left office. And I was intrigued by that arc, the symmetry of the family beginning its journey in California, close to the beginning of statehood for California. August Shuckman, the pioneer, arrived in 1852 in California, you know, became a state in 1850. So I was very struck by the way that the family history really paralleled in so many ways the history of California, and thought that the family, who are very interesting characters and important and obviously had a big impact on California, would be an interesting vehicle to really tell a history of California and to illustrate some of the ways in which California is really a different and very unique place.
And that's a theme in your book, that and also in some of your other writings, you refer to it as the party of California, borrowing from the historian Starr. You give us an explanation of what exactly that means.
Sure, yeah. So Kevin Starr, who was a quite celebrated California historian and also the state librarian, did play various other roles in sort of the history of California, but coined this phrase, the Party of California. It was also used to some degree by Pat Brown, Jerry's father, who was governor for 8 years in the late 1950s and early 60s. And it refers to the idea that there is some loyalty to the idea, to the experience, and to the public good of California and governing in that spirit that often transcends party ideology. And I think it is something that makes California different in a lot of ways, particularly its political systems, because political parties here have from the beginning and traditionally and very deliberately been set up as much weaker vehicles than in a lot of other places. And so you have a lot of historical situations where there have been close alliances across party lines. Pat Brown, for example, was close friends with Earl Warren, who was governor two governors before him and was a prominent Republican. And there also are issues even today in the environment, for example, in which you see a lot of working relationships between prominent Democrats and Republicans. Jerry Brown and his predecessor Arnold Schwarzenegger have worked closely together on a lot of environmental initiatives, particularly those designed to combat climate change. So there is this sense that there are certain values in California, and the environment is a particularly strong one, that often transcend party lines and lead to people working together for the good of the state of California.
And as part of it, and you're a you transplant from New York, I moved here from Washington, D.C., is part of it just this kind of this lure of California and this, to, of its beauty, of its, you know, its natural resources, and you know, what it, that's a big part of the psychology of the state.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's exactly right, and it's certainly something I was struck by when, as you said, I moved from New York, and I think that is something that is something so intrinsic to the character of it. In it, you know, the weather, which lures people in and of itself, and then becomes somewhat of a punchline to a joke in the East. But the weather, as you know, it sort of changes the way people live here, and it not only is a major factor in shaping the lifestyle of California, but also the economy of California, and the reason that the aerospace industry moved to California, the reason that Hollywood is in California and the movie industry is because of the weather and the climate. So all of that becomes very important to preserve and becomes a very, you know, a high value both for its economic impact and also because it is what drew so many people here. And you get then situations where someone like Ronald Reagan, who is often thought of as a very kind of anti-environmentalist president, but as governor actually was a very strong environmentalist and championed a lot of the creation of certain agencies that became important tools in environmental regulation later on.
And when I moved out here in late 1994, I was transitioning most of that year and moved right before the election. And a couple of things, and then I got involved in politics right away, and a couple of things that struck me. One was, obviously, in 1994, you had Kathleen Brown running for governor, and you know, the campaign was very badly managed. She ran out of money right before the end of the campaign, so didn't have any airtime purchase for the last week or so of the campaign. And I remember the White House was furious and said that her campaign manager should be charged with malpractice if there was such a thing in campaigns. But what struck me in becoming acquainted with California was at that time, there was this sense of lost grandeur. And everyone kept referring back to when I learned about Pat Brown, about people talking about what Pat Brown had built was fading. And there was this sense that we weren't keeping up with that legacy, and everyone was pointing to Prop 13. And so I guess, you know, what that told me right at the bat was Pat Brown was really ingrained in the psyche of California, and probably still is.
Right. I think that's definitely true. You know, in talking about the book around California, I run into people almost everywhere who have some sort of experience or encounter or remembrance of Pat Brown. And, you know, he presided over California during these years of tremendous expansion. And there was also a sense of you know, it was the tail end of the post-war boom in California, which was such an important time because the state grew so incredibly fast. There were an average of 1,000 people a day who moved to California for almost a decade. And Pat, who who had this just very exuberant personality, was in some way sort of such a perfect leader for that time, because he fought big and thought that big was better, and sort of delighted in California taking over, overcoming New York to become the most populous state. So he presided over the creation of the State Water Project, the Master Plan for Higher Education, which led to a big expansion in both the university system and the state colleges in California. So it was sort of this real sort of sense of California being the center of everything. And I think that people do look back, you know, particularly in the 90s, in that Depression time and so forth, looked back to the grandeur of those days. Now, he got caught at the end of his two terms when he loses to Ronald Reagan in 66. He got caught up in a lot of the backlash to that, when suddenly, you know, more people meant more traffic and more smog, and the free speech movement at Berkeley was growing into the anti-war movement, really, and there was civil unrest and the Watts riots and so forth. So, you know, he got caught in the political backlash of that. But decades later, what people tend to remember are the earlier years and the big building and expansion of the state.
And it's funny you mention that, because one of the articles I read on your book, they included a photo of his opening of the Santa Monica Freeway. And, it's so much of what people talk about is really how Pat Brown built modern California. And
that infrastructure, you're right.
And the jewel of the crown is the UC system, which, you know, has the most, I mean, obviously he did not create it, but he expanded it and pledged to have tuition-free education from, you know, kindergarten all the way to college, which was important for someone who could not afford college himself and had to go to law school at night instead.
That's right, and that's, I mean, I write in the book, as you know, a lot about the university system and about the University of California at Berkeley in particular, because it was the original piece of the university system. It was the university in its early years, and that Pat Brown sort of represents a continuation of the idea that higher education, accessible higher education, is such an important value in California. And I found that very interesting, and very much a theme also that says a lot about the state. The idea of having tuition-free higher education is actually enshrined in the Constitution in the 1850s. And the university began then. University of California also was admitted women very, very early on, way before many of its East Coast counterparts. And then by 1960, when Pat Brown creates the master plan, or he didn't create it really, Clark Kerr created it, but helps to shepherd it through the legislature and signs it into law, the goal was an expansion of the system, but also really a commitment to have accessible higher education for all. And that was really something that, you know, spread through the rest of the country, but like many things, really started in California. And, you know, it's quite incredible when we think about it now that under his tenure, three entire campuses, San Diego, Irvine, and Santa Cruz, were created from scratch.
In 8 years.
Some of them opened a little bit after him, but the planning and most of the work was done. And, you know, I mean, one thing worth mentioning to keep in mind is that part of the reason that was possible was that there was no environmental movement then. There was no such thing.
True. And
so there were no environmental restrictions. There was no CEQA law, you know.
Right.
So one could build things a lot faster than now.
Now, this
was a lot more open space. I mean, Irvine, the city of Irvine, was actually built up around the university, and the university was the first thing that appeared there. So.
Which is an interesting thought. You would think there was a city there, and the university came second, but that's interesting. The you mentioned Pat Brown's personality, his ubiquity, and I've met Jerry Brown just once, and He doesn't come across like the politician who kind of impresses you with his warmth. And is it fair to say that the dynasty wouldn't have happened in reverse? You would have had Jerry Brown. Jerry Brown exists because Pat Brown, based on what Pat Brown built and Pat Brown's machine. And obviously he got reelected again and again in his own right. But would it have worked in the reverse? Would Jerry Brown have been the one to start the dynasty?
That's a good question. Probably not. I mean, certainly he got interested in politics. I mean, not only was able to enter politics because his name was Edmund G. Brown Jr.,
right,
even though he was always known as Jerry, but that was an enormous help to him because the name was so well known across the state. But beyond that, I mean, this is all very speculative, but clearly he became interested in politics because he grew up in a household where he was surrounded by it all the time. You know, his father was elected, the first office that Pat Brown was elected to was District Attorney of San Francisco, and that was in 1943, and Jerry was 5 years old. So he grew up, in that world. Had he grown up in another world, he very well might have gone in another direction. He's certainly someone with a lot of eclectic interests. But I also think that, it's hard to answer that without sort of taking into account how much they are products and politicians of their times.
True.
One of Pat Brown's failings was his difficulty in adjusting to a world where television became the prime medium for politics, and he was not particularly good at politics. I mean, he was great at retail politics. He was the classic sort of old-fashioned politician who really loved to meet people and thought that, if he could just meet everyone, shake their hands, he could win their votes. And his son is very different, but very good and very adept at the kind of, not that kind of retail politics, but doing television and politics on a very, very strategic about his ability to reach people through TV and radio and cable TV and the internet and so forth. So his personality and political skills are kind of suited much more to the 21st century.
And we're going to take a short break. Just very quickly on that point, I think there's a quote in your book where I think it may even be attributed to Pat Brown, where he says that he ran for president of every organization, even ones he didn't belong to.
when he was in high school. He was a born campaigner, that's right.
So we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have more on the Browns of California after these messages.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Ready to do a podcast for your business? Make that podcast elevate to enterprise level. Let WebmasterRadio.fm expedite and execute your podcast to build your brand and broaden your customer base. WebmasterRadio.fm has worked with the world's biggest tech brands, Google, Yahoo, and Bing, and have worked with fast-growing brands like ShipStation and GoDaddy. Now it's your turn. Contact BRASCO at WMR.FM and rush your enterprise-level podcast into production at a very reasonable rate. Email BRASCO at WMR.FM.
Are you looking for the best in WordPress speed, security, and scalability? WP Engine is a digital experience platform for WordPress, powering digital experiences for large brands around the world. With easy-to-use site management tools and powerful do-it-your-way development features, WP Engine gives you the flexibility to build it your way. Improve your SEO and conversion rates with a faster site on WP Engine. Learn more on WPEngine.com.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back, and we're talking about the legacy of Jerry Brown and Pat Brown with Marion Powell. And I know legacy is a word that the governor does not like, since he still believes he is still very much making history. So we talked a lot about Jerry Brown, excuse me, Evan Brown, is Pat Brown's dad. And but Jerry Brown now is going to be going, when he leaves office, will have served in office the third longest of any governor in the history of the United States, and has quite a record in his own right. What stands out most to you in terms of Brown's legacy?
Oh, it's hard to sort of single out one thing. I mean, he's done so much, and he's been around for so long, and he spans, you know, such a long time. I mean, it's so such a remarkable career to have been both the youngest and oldest governor in California, in addition to his longevity. I think there are different accomplishments and goals compared to the two different times. When he came in as governor in 1975, he was 36 years old. It was coming in the wake of Watergate. He campaigned along with a proposition that he had crafted and championed as Secretary of State that had to do with campaign finance reform. It created the Fair Practices Political Commission, Fair Political Practices Commission, rather, which governs, you know, campaign finance and ethics issues. So he was very much then the face of a new generation and a different kind of government, and arrived in Sacramento with very clearly wanting to shake up the status quo and to change things, and you know, installed women and minorities in jobs they'd never had, brought in a lot of very untraditional people to state government, had a major impact on the composition of the judiciary, which had been sort of overwhelmingly white male, and so really
straight,
challenged the political establishment in you know, in every possible way. Very instrumental in his environmental initiatives, and California is, it's the point at which it begins to really take the lead in regulating car emissions and imposing regulations on the air, on the car industry, through the California Air Resources Board. So that was sort of the some of the highlights of the first term. Also, the Agriculture Labor Relations Act, which he did, in, it was one of his first and really major legislative accomplishments, which is still a law on the books, not used very much, but California is the only state in the country that gives farm workers the right to unionize and has a state agency that protects those rights, because farm workers are not covered under the National Labor Relations Act. So that was a really rather major accomplishment of his first term. And then we have sort of his interesting interim period, his resurgence in Oakland as mayor in 1998, which is a very interesting and unusual way to stage a political comeback all those decades later. And then, I mean, I think one has to look at his ability to come in at a time when California was in really dire financial straits in terms of the state budget. There was a $26 billion with a B deficit when he came into office the second time in 2011. And there was this sense, you know, somewhat comparable to what you described, though, sort of back in the 1990s, of despair about state government, that California was ungovernable, that it was just too big, it was too hard, it was too messed up. And he was able to come in and restore, I think, you know, not only fiscal stability, for which he gets partial credit, but the economy picks up too. I mean, there are other factors, obviously, but also I think a sense of faith in government. You know, if you look at what the polls were showing about what people thought of their state officials, the legislature and the governor and so on, back in the early aughts compared to now, there was an enormous amount of distrust and hopelessness about state government. And I think because in part of his experience and his commitment to public service and that whole trajectory, and in some ways that really is very much what ties him to his father and is a through line in the whole family of that idea of the importance of public service. So he was able to, you know, to push through a tax increase that helped to balance the state budget over a couple of years, and then also to just kind of restore a sense that California could be governed sometimes even in a bipartisan manner, and that there was a role for state government that was not, not a negative thing. I'm part of his, he has been condemned by environmentalists for some of his initiatives and some degree for reaching out too much to the business community. But I think if you look at that, that's also part of that idea that the business community is important to California, that there one needs to sort of govern, as he says, from the middle. He doesn't use this expression that much anymore, but he used to talk about how governing was like paddling a canoe. You paddle a little on the left, you paddle a little on the right.
Right.
He doesn't really say that very much anymore, but I think there is that kind of spirit. And I do think that overall imparting, and this is a more intangible thing, but that sense that that government is not a bad thing and is not all messed up and can actually do some things right is an important piece of the overall Brown legacy.
I would add to that, and start going back to where I started in 94, I don't get that sense now. And I do think there's optimism about California. And I also think that comparing Sacramento to Washington, I think California, in one sense, has already confronted Trumpism and defeated it and shown a better way. We had Prop 187 with Governor Wilson and the whole anti-immigrant thing. And it did take root to an extent. I mean, Prop 187 right. passed, although it was found unconstitutional. Right. But eventually, Wilson won the battle but lost the war. And the Hispanics had completely abandoned the Republican Party. And so what you've seen is a shift in California away from that. That just no longer has any resonance, really, as an electoral way to success. And right. you've seen Jerry Brown build a diverse state, an economy that's booming, a model exact opposite of what's going on 3,000 miles away.
I think that's a hugely important point, and I agree very much with that. I think that, and going back to, there's a Brown tie-in, of course, to Prop 187, because that is, Wilson runs very much on that against Kathleen Brown, and very effectively. So in addition to the problems with her campaign, she's facing that. And I think one of sort of her most admirable moments is that she comes out very strongly against Prop 187 early on and sort of says, no daughter of Pat Brown could possibly support this. And that was not the mainstream Democratic position at that point yet either. She was sort of very early and committed to that. And that is, again, a through stream in this family, too, that some of Jerry Brown's, I think, strongest speeches in the last couple of years and most sort of really passionate ones have been about the need to, California's commitment to protect immigrants regardless of their status here and really to stand up to the things that are going on in Washington. And so, I agree, and I think also, again, the demographic changes that came to California much earlier have been and are gradually spreading across the country. And so, that would be the optimistic view, is that other places will go through sort of what California did back in the 90s. But that commitment to diversity and that idea that California is a state of immigrants, I think also was very interesting to me to trace that back to its founding, because, when gold is discovered in 1849, people rush into California. The whole world rushes in, from immigrants from around literally the world. And so there is a sense, although there have been, bad and ugly times in California's history in terms of racism and anti-immigrant issues, that fundamentally this is a state of immigrants, and that has sort of manifested itself in different ways.
And just to kind of wrap up, the Browns have consistently defended them. Pat Brown was, he defended and fought legal challenges against the internment camps. Jerry Brown obviously has been very vocal, and Kathleen against Prop 187. And so I guess the question that with the end of the Brown era brings is California the exception, or is California the future?
Right. I think that's a very important question. But you know, the other piece of it is that California, and this is what I try to convey to my friends on the East Coast, having lived there and knowing what they think about California, is that California also, by virtue of its size, almost has to be the future, has to play an incredibly important role in the future, because it is the world's fifth largest economy right now. You know, it is the county of Los Angeles has more people in it than 43 states. I mean, the size of California is so important that anything it does has enormous influence. And again, the car emission standards is, you know, probably the best example of that, where if California mandates that cars have to have certain emission standards and gas requirements, then, you know, ultimately that becomes the standard because there's so many people in California buying cars. So I think that people ignore the lessons of California at their peril because, it is such a dominant force.
Well, thank you very much. You'll be speaking at Miami Book Fair on November 18th, and so hopefully if people who are attending get a chance to check out Miriam Powell, The Browns of California, a very important book, and congratulations on an achievement. What is your next project?
I don't know yet. I'm still talking about this one, so that's to be determined.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, and good luck on the remainder of your tour.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, you'll have more of Cyber Law and Business Report after these messages.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Do you look at the task of ranking your site at the top of the search engines like you would climbing the top of Mount Everest? It doesn't have to be. TopSEOs.com knows how hard that climb can be, and they can make top ranking a reality. TopSEOs sends you to only the right search vendors and agencies that they know will work for you. Since 2002, TopSEOs.com has reviewed and researched the best search engine marketing agencies and solutions providers. Don't risk the cost of falling off the proverbial peak of search rankings. Let TopSEOs give you peace of mind. TopSEOs.com, the independent authority on search vendors.
You are now tuned in to the world's largest online radio podcast network for internet marketers looking to dominate the B2B marketplace.
Webmasterradio.fm.
Webmasterradio.fm is home to some of the most respected authorities in all aspects of internet marketing, from SEO to affiliate marketing to social media, e-commerce, mobile marketing, and so much more.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on Webmasterradio.fm.
And we're back, and thanks again to Miriam Powell for quite an achievement, the Browns of California, the family dynasty that transformed the state and shaped a nation. And one of Jerry Brown's achievements as governor was the passage of the California Electronic Communications Privacy Act. And California has become a leading voice in privacy under Governor Brown. And so we're going to now go to a previously recorded segment we had with Chris Conley of the ACLU talking about the passage of the ECPA, the California Electronic Communications Privacy Act. Our next segment, we have Chris Conley from the ACLU in San Francisco. And Chris is going to talk to us about a new law that Jerry Brown just signed last month called California Electronic Communications Privacy Act. Chris, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So this is somewhat of a landmark achievement, getting this law passed, is it?
It is. So it's been significant for a couple of reasons. One is that this is we think this is the strongest electronic privacy law in the nation. It not only requires a warrant for the contents of emails, but also for metadata surrounding those emails, the people with whom you communicate, the location from which you send those emails, all you know, the details about these communications and these activities that we all perform online, that especially in aggregate can be very revealing as to the patterns and activities and incidents of our personal lives. And so this is, as far as we know, the first law in the country that requires a warrant for that broad set of information, as well as for information stored on our personal devices, our smartphones, our laptops, things like that. We had a very good Supreme Court decision a year ago that held that at least to some extent the Fourth Amendment protects information on those devices, but California's law is a little bit broader and pertains not only to physically searching an electronic device, but also to remotely accessing it using devices such as Stingrays, talk about more of those more later if you'd like, or other ways of trying to get information off of these devices. So we think it's a major victory in that sense. It's also something that has been quite a long time coming. We have had three previous bills, actually smaller bills, trying to enact electronic privacy reform in California, all of which Governor Brown vetoed in 2011, 2012, and 2013. So we're very happy that this year we were able to convince him that now was the time to enact comprehensive electronic privacy reform in California.
But was there any change in the content of the bill that was able to address whatever concerns the governor had, or did this, the whole increasing concerns about online privacy change things?
So I think, I mean, the reality is this bill is actually broader than any of the other three bills. In some sense, it's those three bills put together, a few others. It's not exactly the same. There have been some amendments, some of which addressing concerns about how notice and other provisions work, but it was not a narrowing of the bills based on comments. So I think a lot of the change has to do with the our current culture and awareness of surveillance. The Edward Snowden revelations have happened, and part of what happened from that is not only has the general public and the California voters who are Governor Brown constituents become more aware of and more concerned about surveillance, but it's also had a real impact on the technology industry. Companies are very cognizant of the fact that people are becoming somewhat distrustful of sharing their information online. They recognize that out-of-date laws really harm their business. And so this bill was supported not only by civil liberties groups such as the ACLU, but also by a broad coalition of industry, including Google and Facebook and Apple, the California Chamber of Commerce, many others who are not typically, who have not been traditionally supporting this kind of bill, but they have recognized that in this climate, it's really important, not only for their consumers' trust, but it also helps them to deal with, to have a single consistent warrant standard rather than an archaic set of rules that were written 30 years ago that are very hard to apply and put them in difficult situations when they're trying to develop brand new products that weren't contemplated when the old law was written. And they're much better off with a single clear get a warrant standard.
Now, your colleague, Nicole Ozer, had a good article kind of discussing this in TechCrunch recently. And you won on your point that the industry wanted this, that actually at this point enacting this legislation is pro-business. Adobe released a statement that said it believes that customer data stored online deserves the same protection as data stored at home or at work, and that full Fourth Amendment protections are essential to consumers trusting that their information is safe. Without trust, cloud computing can never realize its full potential. And we've had other shows where we've had people talk about how, the ongoing fallout from the Snowden revelations is just killing us in Europe in cloud computing. And so something like this goes a long way, it would seem, to kind of bolstering our domestic cloud computing industry.
Certainly. I mean, it's very obvious in the international sphere, particularly in the recent weeks where, the safe harbor has been challenged as, a direct consequence of the NSA and the Snowden revelations. But even within the U.S., there's increasing evidence that consumers, that online users are skeptical about the ability to keep their information safe. And while that hasn't stopped people from using the internet, it certainly affects the way that they use it. And as Adobe said, that people hold back. They do not fully engage with services and environment that they don't trust. And so making sure that we have clear, consistent, up-to-date laws that protect personal information really, is essential not only for the international play where they're other factors at stake. But even within the U.S., just talking about consumers themselves, this is something that, again, it's very clear that the industry sees this as valuable and has actively supported this.
Well, one thing that surprised me, and this was also in Nicole's comments in TechCrunch, was the degree to which these requests for information from cell phones and metadata, et cetera, were being made by law enforcement without a warrant, and that this is seen to be rampant. And there's just an increasing amount. I believe the one-third of the requests had only one-third of the requests from law enforcement of the approximately 2,000-some requests had a warrant.
Yeah, and this is exactly what CalACPA was designed to address. CalACPA is our abbreviation for the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, because I say that too often, I get my tongue tied. the problem has been that, you know, in both the statutory and constitutional level, the courts and lawmakers have not really brought existing privacy protections up to date with electronic and advances in technology. So, for example, the federal law that protects electronic information has a provision that that requires a warrant to obtain the contents of an electronic communication, but only if it is in electronic storage, which is a specifically defined term, for less than 180 days. This was written in the 1980s when email worked, because you logged into your probably CompuServe or AOL or Prodigy or some, you know, bulletin board system, basically, and you downloaded all your emails to your computer. And so the concept at that time was, well, if you left it on the server for 6 months, you've abandoned it. It's stuff you don't care about anymore. And that's obviously not the way we treat our email today. We trust our web server to keep it because they're more reliable than the hard drive on our laptop. It's actually it's more protected, probably technically as well. You know, Google has better security protection than I do on my personal device. And so it has completely changed the paradigm, but the law remains outdated. And so there are loopholes and gaps and gray areas where the law currently allows access to even to content without a warrant. Now, the courts have started to engage with this. There was a decision called United States versus Warshak in the Sixth Circuit that said that you do need a warrant. The Fourth Amendment demands this, even if the federal statute does not. But that has not yet been, that has not been taken up by the Supreme Court and or any other circuit. And so it's not even clear whether the Fourth Amendment covers content. And then you get to information like location, you know, communications, associational information, records of your browsing history or your purchases, all of this fine-grained information that is collected in such detail today and that can paint a very comprehensive picture of your activities. And that is even lower protection in the statutory regime and has yet to really be updated in the constitutional courts.
So. And in terms of, we're talking about loopholes, would one of those loopholes be stingrays?
So stingrays are stingrays are also known as IMSI devices, International Mobile Subscriber Identity Catchers. These are essentially devices that act as fake cell towers. You can station a stingray somewhere and it will say, hey, connect to me and tell me who you are, cell phones, and I will route calls to you. In doing so, the cell phones nearby are encouraged to hand over their identifying information so that the stingray and whoever's operating it can determine which cell phones are nearby. And these have been used, there have been many problems with these, but the two most obvious are, number one, they have not been used with consistent legal process. It seems that the federal government has recently announced a policy that they will use stingrays they will get a warrant before using a stingray. That implies they have not always been getting a warrant in the past, at least. And other entities at the state and local level, it's not clear what they are doing. And in addition, stingrays have been used very conspicuously in ways that have hidden their existence. You know, cops have essentially lied to the courts about what's going on. They have claimed that a confidential informant told them that a person was in a residence when, in fact, they used a stingray to determine that. They have broken down doors to houses to avoid getting a warrant, because getting a warrant would require them to explain to the judge what it is, why it is they believe a person is in the house. And so this, both the lack of adequate legal process protecting this and the lack of transparency have been problematic. And the legal process is particularly relevant here because stingrays, by design, capture information not about one specific person, but about every phone that's nearby. Now, they can figure to not use that, but that's not automatic. And so knowing how they're being used is certainly important. And we definitely wanted, this is something that is new technology that the courts have not really, have just started to grapple with, partly because they are just becoming aware of it. And we wanted to make sure that that California's privacy law encompassed not just, searching my phone by taking it out of my hand and flipping it with your fingers, but using a stingray or using, a remote exploit or whatever it may be to access data on my phone without physically interacting with it.
And, especially one thing that's been very troubling in the stingrays is sometimes they have actually dismissed cases against defendants rather than have to disclose information about the use of the stingray.
So yeah, that's right.
Apparently it's thought valuable to be used to catch, perceived criminals, but they would rather have those criminals on the street than actually disclose what's involved in using it. That's right. Troubling.
That's very troubling. I mean that kind of turns that is the purpose of law enforcement is to protect public safety. And if secrecy has somehow superseded public safety as a goal, that's deeply problematic. And it also suggests that law enforcement is increasingly viewing what they're doing, like secrecy is paramount, and it can be very dangerous to our democratic society when it becomes an us versus them mentality. We can't tell them, being the population, what we're doing at all. We will, we will decline prosecutions. We will let people walk the streets because we're not willing to use the evidence we collected. Now, maybe we're not willing to use it because we would have to admit that we used it, we got it illegally. That's a completely different story, but there should be, and I think at least with stingrays, we are finally seeing responsible policies around how to adopt these or when they can be deployed. But that's still very much a work in progress.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't recall reading anywhere in the Fourth Amendment the words, trust me.
that is definitely not in there. the Fourth Amendment is about the right of the people to be secure. And that the right of the people, it's not the right of law enforcement to engage in surveillance without transparency, without judicial oversight, without the protections of a search warrant. Not to say that, then there need to be and are in CALACPA and in federal law exceptions. If there is a burning building, you don't need to go back and get a search warrant to figure out who's in it. If there's a suspect fleeing or threatening to destroy information, there have to be some kind of provisions where a search warrant is not immediately available. But
right.
At the same time, and this is one of the things we also thought about, there should be after-the-fact validation. It shouldn't be, well, I'm going to say there's an emergency, so you have to give me everything, and it's completely outside of the scope of this law. It needs to be not just an exception, but a justice
right.
Slightly postponed, right? There's obviously justice delayed is justice denied to some extent, but we want to make sure that a judge does eventually see this, that this was why I didn't get a warrant right away. This is why I could have gotten a warrant if I had the time. Basically going through an after the fact evaluation of whether this was a legitimate warrant, what any kind of surveillance or any demand for information is very important in this context.
Now, we've talked a little bit about the federal law, which is somewhat dated. And last several years, there's been a lot of effort and a lot of lobbying from the tech industry for an update to the Federal Electronic Communications Privacy Act. Why hasn't that passed, do you believe? And where are we now in this Congress?
So I am based in San Francisco. It fully qualified to say why it has not passed, but I think what we have seen is, there has been pushback, and I'm very hopeful that with the Snowden revelations, that not just in California but through in DC as well, constituents are telling their legislators that this is important to me, that this is valuable. This was also part of our purpose for pushing this bill in California. It was not simply to protect Californians, but to really try to move forward the national conversation. We believe that this, hopefully CALACPA can be a model for possibly for other states to begin with, other states across the country could take this and enact this and eventually ratchet up the pressure on DC to get it done. As to exactly why, again, that's beyond my pay grade. There has been, I mean, there are 300 Republican co-authors of the current sitting bill, but it's still having trouble getting through committees and getting out to the floor. And that's something that I think is going to take, you know, continued pressure, may take some changes in the regime hearing. I don't know whether the House will look a little different in the next few months, given the leadership change, but maybe that will be what it needs.
Could be. And we only got a few minutes left, but one quick question, you know, given what you do, and you obviously you're in San Francisco, clearly a very aware tech community, what has been the reaction in terms of people coming to you who, you know, normally maybe would not, you know, just saying, I'm concerned? You know, do you, just in your interactions, are you seeing an increase in concern or, you know, maybe some perplexedness about what's going on?
I think we definitely are. You know, there's an awareness that surveillance happens and that there are legitimate needs for surveillance, even when, you know, keeping our country safe, arresting criminals means sometimes doing things in secret, sometimes obtaining information that would ordinarily be private. But what we have seen and what people have really expressed concern about is turning the mantra of, you know, transparent by default into secret by default. Turning the mantra of we always get a warrant to we only get a warrant if we absolutely have to. And if we can find any way to go around that, we do so. And so we have really, you know, that has resonated with people, with companies, with individuals, even with law enforcement, who really have seen their public relationships erode because the communities, particularly communities of color, religious communities, are increasingly skeptical that they are treated as members of community and rather than targets of surveillance. And so the San Diego Police Officers Association was actually one of the supporters of this bill. And they said that we think this is really important step for us to step forward and say we can protect public safety and respect individual rights, that we need to go through the process. We need to get a judge to approve this in order to convince our community that we have their best interests at heart. And so I think really that was one of the key things for Cal ECMA. And I think it's one of the things that is changing is that communities, especially, again, communities of color, Islamic communities, feel like targets. They don't feel like the police are there to protect them. They feel like the police are there to threaten them. And the more that transparency and accountability are built into our laws, the easier it is for police to rebuild those relationships.
Okay, we only have 2 minutes left. If people want to learn more about what you and the ACLU are doing on this issue, where should they go?
So the ACLU Northern California is at aclunc.org. You can also learn more about the federal effort to reform this. The main coalition working on this in federal level is Digital Due Process, Digital Due Process.org. I just say it rather than try to spell it out. It's something that definitely is getting traction in D.C. So the more you can do to join efforts locally and at the federal level to kind of push this ball forward, the better off we will all be and the more likely we are to have technology that flourishes and privacy laws that keep up with our modern technology rather than are dated before the introduction of the World Wide Web.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much. It's been a pleasure having you, and thank you for this insight, and congratulations on your hard work paying off. This is an important development in California. That's all the time we have for this week. Thank you for joining us. Join us next week on Cyber Law Business Report. Check us out on cyberlawradio.wordpress.com for our show notes, and follow us on Twitter at Cyber Law Radio. This is Bennett Kelly. Have a great week.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.
Mother's Day is almost here, and you can get her the most beautiful time-tested gift around. A watch she can wear every day for Movement. Whether mom's into classic dress watches, rare and refined ceramics, or tried-and-true bestsellers, Movement has something she'll love. And right now, you can save big on the best Mother's Day gift ever with up to 50% off site-wide during Movement's Mother's Day sale at MVMT.com. Again, that's up to 50% off. at MVMT.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.